Okay, folks, you are listening to Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. I am once again, I'm delighted to say, with the wonderful Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, thank you for joining me.
Happy to be here.
That's right. We've got some great responses and reactions to our recent podcast.
People can be so kind.
Yeah. What do you think about the way the people come back to us and talk to us? It's very gratifying.
Oh,
isn't
I love it. We've had, you know, obviously some lovely spats on Twitter, which are always very entertaining. Yeah. But, yeah, keep them coming, everybody.
That is absolutely right. Sorry, caught out there. I was distracted.
He's now, raking through his notes.
Yeah, Leslie Ann, through my journals. We had this conversation off air, but we should remind people about it. Do you remember a television show called How?
Yeah, of course I do. Fred Dinage. Oh, yeah. Who was the woman on that?
Jill Graham.
Yes.
So the team was Jack Hargreaves. He used to smoke a pipe. He had glasses and a moustache. Fred Dinage, Jill Graham and John Miller.
That was a race home from school to watch
was it
kind
really?
Of programme. I was fascinated by all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was basically how do you do such and such?
That's
or
right.
How does some such and such come about?
It was almost like a television version of... For boys, the Eagle Annual, and for girls, the Bunty.
Bunty, yeah, definitely.
You know
was.
What I mean?
And I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely loved it. And what they used to do is, they used to do things like, they'd show you how, for instance, a ship went into a bottle. And of course, you know, when you're a little kid, you can't work this out. But of course, what they do is they fold the masts down and then push the ship through the neck of the
and
bottle.
And then you pull the
and
string
they have a piece
and it
of cotton
all stands
and they,
up.
And, yeah. And they pull them up. But the one that, and the reason we're talking about this is because they're thinking of bringing it back.
Well, they did bring it back because it was presented by a guy called Gaz Top.
Oh, yeah.
At some point.
Really?
In the, whenever it was, yeah. I think when my kids were little,
yeah.
It did make a comeback, so... Obviously, there's a demand for it.
That lady, by the way, you asked about, Jill Graham. Oh, no. This is Sally James. She used to work
Oh, yeah, Sally. Yeah, yeah.
She's apparently 86 now.
No, she's not.
It says here, Miss James is 86.
She definitely is not, because she's a friend of mine and I see her all the time.
Oh.
She's married to Mike Smith, the music business exec.
Oh, that's Sally James. This is a different one. Hang on. I'm not sure where the name James came from. Anyway, look. Hang on. Oh, Bunty James. I'm sorry. There's a lady called Bunty James used to work on it. She's 86. Okay. By the way, you just mentioned Sally James and who? Mike who?
Mike Smith. Not the Mike Smith. The DJ Mike
no,
Smith.
No, but he nearly killed her by crashing his helicopter, didn't he?
No, that's the DJ Mike Smith, but he sadly died.
No, it's not.
Yeah,
the Mike
it
Smith
is.
Who crashed his helicopter.
Yeah,
was...
he and Sarah Green, who were married.
Yes, that's right.
So they did have a helicopter crash.
Oh, I see, right.
And he's
okay.
Now deceased, but Sarah Green is still alive.
Oh, I see.
But Sally James and Mike Smith that I know,
right.
Mike Smith was a music business executive.
I see, okay.
Different guy.
Well, the Mike Smith I'm talking about, who crashed his helicopter, right, he... We wrote a story about him once, or I wrote a story about him, and it wasn't terribly flattering. It was about something that had happened on his, you're right, on his Radio 1 show or something like that. You
he
know.
Was a big star in the
big 80s. Big star.
As and, Radio 1 DJs were,
yeah,
because they were
right,
on top
yeah.
of the pops every week.
That's right. And I went off down to Broadcasting House, you know, this story, and I wrote the story. And the next day, he phoned me in the newsroom, you know, and said, hello, I want to speak to Mike Parry. And I said, oh, yeah, that's me. He said, right, he said, this is Mike Smith. I said, oh, yeah, hello. And then he gave me a great moan about, you know, the story and the way I'd written it. And I said, well, every word of it's true. He said, was it really? Okay. He said, look, I tell you what.
What was the story? What had he done?
I can't remember. I honestly can't remember. He'd had a spat with a listener or something like that. You know what I mean?
Bit of a ladies' man in those days as well. Bit of a ladies' man.
Bit of a ladies' man, certainly. And... he said, what sort of a phone have you got there? I said, what do you mean, what sort of a phone have you got? He said, well, are you able to transfer? And I said, I'd have to go back to the switchboard. Who do you want to speak to? He said, I want to speak to your editor, Nick Lloyd. He's a big mate of mine. And I thought, you know,
why didn't you
half
phone
bake.
Him first then?
Yeah, you half bake, you know, trying to intimidate me. Like I said, look, I tell you what, Mike, you give me your number. I said, I won't put you up to switchboard. I'll go and give this number to my editor, Nick Lloyd, and get him to ring you back. And I'll stand there while he supports me over you, okay? Because that story was published in his name. He's the editor, right? Don't you start trying to bully me, pal, you know, about, you know, telling me you're going to speak to my editor, you know. And then he backed down and went away. Anyway, the point of the story is we're going to bring this thing how back, right? And I don't quite know why. But the one that really got me, which I didn't know about, was, and I don't think I ever saw this, was how to, what's this? Yeah, how to put an egg through the neck of a bottle, a boiled egg, without smashing it. Did you know this?
No, I'm just trying to visualise that. So, yeah. So an unboiled, like a raw egg?
A raw egg.
Without breaking it?
Without breaking it.
And you push it through the neck of a bottle?
Yeah, well, what you do is, right, and I had no idea this was what you did. I'm trying to find it now in my
That's
notes
got to
here.
Be impossible.
No, it's not. You fill the bottle half full of water and then you put the egg in the neck of the bottle.
So it's sitting on the top.
It's sitting on the
rim.
Top.
Uh-huh.
And even if it's, you know, exceeding each side of the neck of the bottle by an inch either side, it works. And what happens is the water turns to steam, causes a vacuum and starts sucking the egg into the bottle. But it also makes the shell pliable because of the steam heat coming up into the egg.
I am so going to go home and try this.
Yeah, you've got to try it. And then it goes into the bottle, right? Hole, it doesn't smash or anything, and it does. It looks like a miracle. It's pretty unbelievable, that, isn't it? But
you haven't tried it.
I haven't tried
no,
it.
I'm
no,
I'm going to go home and try this.
Yeah, go and try it. Find
something
yourself a bottle
I can't resist.
And an egg. Now, in our last podcast, we talked about cooking meals home and all that kind of stuff, right? Now, since then, one of my journals has produced a report, and the headline on it is 8 million Britons living alone. The total has grown 600,000 in 5 years. As fewer middle-aged people marry. Now, is that a phenomenon now that you and I are immersed in?
We are part of the phenomenon, being single people ourselves.
Right.
Yeah, and I've got many friends who live alone as well.
Really?
At this stage in the game. In fact, I've even been talking with two of my oldest girlfriends. We were at school together from when we were 11.
Yes.
And we are all three of us single. We've been talking about buying a, not a retirement home, but buying a property between us that we will live in together, have the ground floor as a communal living space, where we can have meals together, dance around the kitchen, have a jukebox, all of that, but have our own floors. So we each have a floor in this house.
Yeah. How many floors would be four?
So, no, there are three of us. So, you know, be a big place.
Yeah, but you'd have ground floor communal.
Yeah.
And then one, two, three.
And a floor each. But then we'd have...
You'd have to have a lift.
Well, we'd have to have a lift.
Yeah.
Or stand a stair lift, you know, with a commode.
Well, no.
Commode built in, maybe.
No. What I'm saying, the reason you'd need a lift is because whoever's living on the fourth floor will eventually find it difficult to go up three flights
of course.
Stairs.
And we'd also have staff. So we'd have a cook.
Yeah.
We'd have a nurse on site.
Right.
You know, we'd have it all sort of live in.
Yeah.
That is our fantasy. But I read a piece in the paper just a few days ago.
Right.
A bunch of Chinese women, seven of them, they've stolen our idea. And they've built a house where seven of them live together.
And where is this?
This is somewhere in China.
Oh, I see, in China. Yeah.
Yeah.
So are you saying that it's like, almost like an English version of the kibbutz?
Well, no, it's more Golden Girls.
Right.
We wouldn't be turning our hand to growing vegetables or anything like that.
Right.
We'd have other people to do that for us.
Right, I see.
You can come and visit. You can be the token man at our dinner parties.
Exactly. Apparently, divorce rates are at a 50-year low. Family breakups continue at a high level because of the growing numbers of cohabiting couples. And as a result, more than half the people in this country now end up single. Now, it also says that more and more people living alone later life, it's vital that our homes and communities reflect this shift and are able to support us. It says that well-designed new homes, which require little maintenance, okay, walkable streets, because they're in nice neighbourhoods, you know, which are purpose-built, increasingly good public transport to get cars off the road, all make it a viable option for people, okay? Now, you say that, and I love that idea that you've got, but you've got to have two really good friends to be able to do that, because it would be car crash living, because it just, you'd all start falling out if you didn't know each other very well.
Yeah, I think it would work in our case because we've been friends for such a long time.
Yes.
I can't see it working with complete strangers.
No, it wouldn't.
Wouldn't really want to share my living space.
It'd be like going back to being a student.
Flat
and three
sharing.
People living in a house and flat sharing
fun.
And all that.
That's not
but
fun.
As long as you all knew each other, because, of course, the thing in this country, which has disappeared almost, is the generational family home, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, granny, mum and dad, children. How often do you see that now?
Well,
hardly ever.
I didn't see it very often in my childhood, I must admit. I mean, I had all four grandparents when I was a child.
Yes.
But we didn't all live together.
No.
And that wasn't really a common thing in my family.
No. It's very Italian, isn't it?
Previous generation. Yeah, and also Indian.
Indian, very Indian.
The guys down my local dry cleaner, they've got four generations living in a house.
Yes.
And they're all very happy because there's always somebody there to look after the kids.
Yes.
So I think that has gone a lot because women work now in a way that they didn't maybe a couple of generations ago.
Sure.
So that's probably the reason that's changed.
Yes.
But in terms of staying single, you know, I quite often get people say to me, why is a woman like you on her own?
Right.
Now, what does that even mean, a woman like you?
Well, do you say because I want to be?
Well, for sure. So if I met somebody at this age, after having been divorced, that new man won't have invested 30-odd years in me to have earned the right for me to look after him into his frail old age.
Yes.
Why should I do that if somebody hasn't been around in my life and contributed to a marriage all that time?
Sure.
I'd much rather be by myself.
Yeah, no, of course, I totally agree. I've been by myself most of my life. I mean, I've lived with ladies and shacked up with them. I think the longest was about a year, I suppose, and all that, but never got married, never committed myself to the long-term relationship because I knew in the end I wouldn't want to commit to it because most of my life has been based around working and it's a very selfish point of view. It's a very selfish life, you know. If I want to, I mean, you know the business we're in. Somebody rings and it's a story. You go and you don't have any consideration for what else you should be doing and when you go, you have no idea when you might come back or when you might come home.
Exactly.
And you know, you don't give over much time for the consideration of what everybody else wants to do. You're very selfish, you're self-centred. Most of the best people in this world are. Lewis Hamilton concentrates on motor racing to the exclusion of everything else. That's why he's one of the greatest champions of all time.
But is it about selfishness or is it about freedom and the fact that we appreciate and enjoy our freedom and that we don't feel the need to share that with someone else?
Yeah, I
so then people say, where does the sex angle come in? Well, sex. Once the old hormones stop raging and jumping around, don't really think about that very much.
No.
I know more married couples who never have sex than I know single people who are out there jumping around.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. And funny thing is, I mean, I'm not trying to be boastful here, but I mean, occasionally you reflect. No, I've met, I would say, about four women of a certain age over the last couple of years. And I determine certain age between 40 and 55, okay? In various forms of business and various situations, some social, some business, some connected with a one-off job of work where I've met them, where I know that had I worked on it, it would have ended up
You could have had them.
In Rumpy Pumpy.
Oh, my goodness.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
So you didn't go for it?
No,
any
I didn't
of the
go
times?
For it. No,
now, why not?
I pull back on obligation. Not commitment, but obligation. I never liked one-night stands, okay? I always felt like a bit of a cad, you know, leaving the next day and all that kind of stuff. I always sent flowers, by the way, after a one-night stand and that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? No, I did.
That's very sweet.
No, I did. I always felt like that. And I always felt... And yet, you know, so many of my mates never had a conscience like that whatsoever. And so many women always said they didn't mind, you know, it wasn't a problem, all that kind of stuff. I always felt uncomfortable with it. And the problem is, and I'm probably being very unfair to the women now, concerned, I'm thinking, look, this lady's 50, right? I'm a few years older than her. She will see me as a great catch, which she would, because, you know, I'm lucky enough to be, you know, reasonably... affluent. And
so she's looking long term. She's thinking of you as a marriage prospect rather than just a shag.
Well, maybe not a marriage prospect, but certainly a long time commitment. You can see it, and you know, I can see it in the mannerisms.
So you
and all
think
that kind
women
of stuff.
Are really programmed to do that? That we're all sort of heat seeking missiles, you know, looking for an ideal suspect to get our claws into.
A lot of women do still crave a partner in life, and a lot of women are frightened of living on their own.
Now why is that? I'm not.
You're not, because you're obviously a very strong, independently minded, intelligent, successful career woman, and so you don't have a problem. But a lot of women still do. A lot of women still stay in abusive relationships because they're simply frightened of being on their own.
Well, that's true.
You know, and
or they stay in unsatisfactory relationships that really aren't working, and they know the husband is doing stuff on the side, being unfaithful, being dishonest, but they put up with it rather than be by themselves. Yeah, why? Yeah. Why? Yeah.
I totally agree. But these at least four women I know have felt disappointed about it. You know, two of them
have
told me.
They've expressed that to you?
Yeah, two of them have. You know, why can't we get it on? You know, one of them said, well, I don't understand where. And
were they nice looking ladies? Didn't really do it for you. Okay.
Yes.
Not bad.
But the problem was, I thought, because, one of them lived very close by, and I thought, well, you know,
handy.
That's no good. Sorry?
Handy.
Well, not handy, because, you know, the problem
she'll
is...
she'll stalk you after it's all over.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you get the bunny boilers around.
Well, that was my thought. I thought, if I only commit my... You know, if I just weaken once... I mean, I went out for one of these ladies, right? And we went to a restaurant on Epsom Downs, okay? You know, Epsom Racecourse and beautiful part
of the
world.
Yeah, it's nice there.
And we had a long lunch and all that. And then I was very tempted, you know, because she'd finished work of the day and I thought... You know, shall I? And at the last moment, I decided not to, because I thought this is going to cause me too much grief if she takes this as a sign of anything other than an afternoon's recreation. You see what I mean?
So do people of our vintage still have one-night stands, have afternoon recreation? Do they really?
I think they do. If you read all the sex surveys in my journals, I mean, women are now, what's the word, cougarish? In a way they...
Not all women are.
Well, no, but
that's
a lot
always
are.
Got, it's got a predatory are. Connotation,
a
hasn't it?
What?
A predatory connotation.
Well, sort of. But no, I mean, the point is, I would rather just go home and shut the door and get on with the things I like doing. Like, you know, reading, watching the television, going back through all my emails, trying to sort out what I'm going to be doing tomorrow and that kind of stuff, then to have to involve myself emotionally. I think that's the problem.
You've hit the nail on the head.
Emotionally.
So you don't want emotional exchanges with these people.
No.
At best, it would be a physical encounter.
Absolutely right.
And you've got a conscience, therefore you're not going to indulge in that.
That's the way I feel.
Fair enough.
That's the way I feel.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Okay, folks, you are listening to Planet Porky, and delighted to say Leslie Ann Jones is with me. Leslie Ann, thank you very much indeed.
Here I am.
People love to hear our Fleet Street tales. They love to hear yours, because they're all about very famous people, usually, and the amazing things you've done. But I've got an extraordinary story here. Have you ever heard of Dennis Nilsson?
Oh, yeah. This is a weird one, because... Yeah. Was it Cranley Gardens where he lived in North London?
Yes.
So some very good friends of mine lived in the house next door.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because I've got a similar story. Yeah, go on.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've got Doctor Who playing him.
David Tennant.
Who
looks identical
to him.
Doesn't
he? It's really eerie.
They've just put out the, you know, the advances on this series they're making. Just to explain to our listeners, right, Dennis Nilsson was a guy who worked in an employment bureau in North London, and he'd been a loner all his life. He'd been a former policeman, actually, funny enough, and therefore he came across destitute young men. And what he'd do is, near closing time at the employment bureau, he'd say, "You poor lad, you look frozen stiff. Look, go and sit down over there. Excuse me. I finish in 5 minutes, and... I'll take you for... No, I'm fine, thanks. Leslie Ann's offering me water, but it's just the air conditioning.
How do you know it's
don't
water?
Worry.
It's the Guinness in there.
It's the Guinness, yeah. He said, go and sit over there. He said, you look a bit cold. I'll buy you a drink and a plate of chips in the pub next door. So the young guy who was homeless, you know, and destitute and all that, oh, what a nice, kind man. So then they'd have a few drinks. And then he'd say, you know, where are you going to sleep tonight? Oh, I'm on the streets. Oh, you're on the streets. Well, I can't have that, you know. And he lived in Cranley Gardens, which was a walk away from whichever high street Cranley Gardens is near. Do you know where
North it's West somewhere.
Yeah, something yeah. Like, yeah, yeah.
Not really my neck of the woods.
No, nor mine. So so then he'd say, come on, you can use my spare room for the night. So they'd go back, have a few more drinks and all that. And in the middle of the night, Dennis Nielsen would usually strangle them with a piece of rope or something like that. But then he would sit them in his armchair in the lounge for the next 3 or 4 days. And that's why the journalist who researched all this called the book Killing for Company. Because Dennis Nielsen would then come home the next day from his work at the employment office and sit there with a drink and talk to them as if they were still alive while he switched the television on.
Freak.
And the way Dennis Nielsen disposed of the bodies was...
Yeah, even worse.
He cut them all up with, you know, butcher's saws and everything in his own kitchen and once a month would have a bonfire in the back garden and explain to neighbours who were revolted by the smell, because the smell of burning flesh. He'd say things like... vermin, you know, he'd caught vermin in his flat and he bought them and he's burning them and all that. You know, the local authorities suggested I should burn them and all that. When that started to wear thin, he started flushing them down the toilet.
So the drains were all bunged with human flesh.
The drains were all bunged up with human flesh. A guy from Dino Rod came along, opened a manhole and then immediately called the police. But when the police got there, they found a head in his kitchen, in the fridge, because he couldn't get rid of the head.
But he went a long time uncaught, this guy.
Years.
Yeah.
Years.
Now, question. Why do I want to watch a series on TV about this guy?
Yes.
It's revolting enough to know that he existed.
Yes.
And to have read all about it.
Yes.
I think a lot of it I didn't read.
Who was your friend who lived next door?
Oh, Gary and Julie. They lived in, you know, the same
place. Okay. All right.
They shipped out pretty great. But that house came up for sale and
somebody bought it. That's right. It was a flat. It was a house broken into three flats and this was the top one.
But why do I want to watch this on TV?
Yeah.
Are you going to watch this?
Well, I don't know, but I was involved in this story as a reporter. So I'm in the newsroom in the Daily Express in Fleet Street, and all of a sudden a guy called Mike Steamson comes running over, who was a panic merchant. You know, well, he was the deputy news editor, you know. Incredible mass murder and all this kind of... Calm down, Mike. What was it? He said, some bloke's been found in a flat in North London. They found bodies in the house. He's been burying bodies in the garden. He's been flushing out. So better get round there, hadn't we? You know, and so... I said, so have we got the address? He said, yeah, I've got the address here. He said, 38 Cranley Gardens. Bloke sitting opposite me was a great reporter, older than me in those days, called Alex Henry. And Alex lived at 44 Cranley Gardens.
Unbelievable.
And, and as he read the address out, Alex said, what?
Oh, yeah. He's my neighbour.
Yeah, he said that's
he
two
must
doors.
Have known the guy.
2 doors down from me. No, he didn't, because this guy was a complete loner.
Okay.
You know, he went out early in the morning to work. He came back late at night because he was in the pub next door with all these young men and all that kind of stuff. And of course, they told Alex to come with me, because then we could get through the police cordon.
Because he was going home
to
his house.
Exactly.
Very clever.
He could prove that he was a neighbour.
So if you're David Tennant...
Yes.
And you're offered this role.
Yes.
Apart from the fact that he looks very similar, what on earth would induce you to want to play such an evil person?
Well,
apart from the money.
Well, I
would
think
you want
because
your reputation connected to something
well,
like this?
Yeah, but it's an acting role, and it's very skillful to try and portray the menace and the evil of this man. Here, I've got the name of the journalist here. The TV production, starring, as you quite rightly say, David Tennant, is based on material from biographer Brian Masters' book called Killing for Company. The victims of Nielsen, nicknamed Dez, would be lured to his London home and strangled or drowned. Drowned some of them in the bath, apparently.
Oh,
right? Strangled or drowned from 1978 to 1983. After killing them, he bathed them, dressed them in his own clothes, and sat them in the lounge for up to 3 or 4 days before dissecting their bodies. I mean, it's just... Nielsen was jailed for life in February 1983.
He's dead now, isn't he?
Yeah, and died in prison last year. That's why they've decided to do it, okay?
But, so, yeah, they can't libel him anymore by interpreting the story however they wish.
No, and to answer your question, the producers say... Our programme focuses on the emotional impact of those terrible crimes, both on those who came into contact with Nelson himself and also on the victims' families. Because, funnily enough, there were two survivors. There were two that he strangled, you know, and thought he'd killed them at the night, who actually woke up. One of them did a runner, and the second one walked into the lounge, and Dennis Nelson just said, oh, you had a bottle of vodka last night, you... Clearly, you know, you were fantasising and all that, you know. Anyway, goodbye, and just let him go. And the guy only became a witness after the discovery of the murders when the guy realised Nelson had tried to kill him. Can you imagine that?
Get compensation? Hmm? Did the survivors get compensation?
Well, I don't know. I suppose there must have been a case for that. But, I mean, what could they compensate them for? The fact that the killer tried to kill them but didn't actually kill them, they didn't go to the police afterwards.
But if you're somebody of this kind of disposition who might be likely to have a go at this kind of thing, you're only going to be encouraged by watching a programme of this nature. Mm-hmm. Don't try this at home.
Yeah, well, yeah, you say that, but I don't know. Talking about... programmes, which, because a lot of this will involve the press as well, because the fact that the story was there for years and nobody discovered it, despite the fact that my mate lived two doors down, he was a reporter of the Daily Express, and there was a mass murderer
on his doorstep.
On his doorstep. And for years he was mocked after that, you know.
Oh, you can imagine.
Mass murderer two doors up, and you can spot him, what kind of a reporter are you, and all that kind of stuff. Well, it's very hard to spot a mass murderer if he's flushing bodies down the drain, you know.
Imagine if that's, you know, you get the drain scenario where things back up your drains.
Yeah.
And you suddenly find bits of human flesh backing up in your toilet.
It happened a bit like that, honestly. Anyway, look, what I was going to say is that from that perspective, I've never yet seen a TV programme that has portrayed a newsroom or a newspaper
accurately.
Properly. Have you?
No, well, no. There was that one quite recently that was, I thought it wasn't too bad. It was Slated.
And was it about the posh paper and the tabloid?
Yeah.
One was a red top. And the other one was like a Guardian-type paper.
That's right.
And the bloke who was in it was the guy who was in Apple Courtyard or something.
Yeah, and he was very good. But what... And I thought the woman reporter in it was very good. What was it called?
It was called The Post, wasn't it? Wasn't it called The Post?
No, I don't think it was.
I think it was called The Post.
I quite liked it, you know. And people were saying, how inaccurate it was. But Roy Greenslade was a consultant on that series.
Oh, well, that's the kiss of death then. If Roy was a consultant. Roy's view of tabloid journalism was making things up, because Roy at one stage, Roy, if you're listening, you know this is true, was the editor when, I'm not saying that he was responsible, there was a scandal about the Spot the Ball competition being rearranged, shall we say. Okay.
On The Sun.
I'm not sure which paper it was on, because Roy worked on The Sun.
He was my boss on The Sun.
Oh, was the only boss on The Sun, but he then became editor of The Mirror.
I had a column on The Sun then, and he oversaw my column.
He oversaw your column, I bet he was good at that. But he...
That's not a euphemism.
No, it's not. It's not a euphemism at all. But he was also the editor of The Mirror, and worked for Maxwell, I think. So Roy, later in life, made a career out of slating tabloid newspapers and a column in The Guardian.
He did, didn't he?
Yeah, but in fact, he'd worked at the very coalface of them and took all the money from the tabloid proprietors in those days. Anyway, look, the one I was going to talk about was... Here, this is something out of The Crown. Are you watching The Crown?
I'm not watching The Crown, but my daughter watches it, right. So I get to hear all about it. Okay. I haven't got the patience to sit and watch it, must say.
Okay, so
quite fictitious, I think, from some of the stuff she's been telling me.
Well, you know, you never know what happened inside the royal family. That was the problem, because it was always a closed shop, wasn't it, for so many years.
They don't know either.
No? No, that's true.
So I've got a lot of respect for Peter Morgan, the guy who created the series.
Oh, okay, fine. Anyway, apparently in one... there's a reporter who's got a story about Prince Philip. His contact comes into the pub and tells him the story. The guy then goes to a phone, picks it up, and barks down the phone to the man at the other end, who is supposed to be his editor, "Give me 600 words and hold the front page. You won't regret it." And then he's put straight onto copy and then dictates 600 words, which is never checked or sub-edited or looked at or examined before it appears as the splash story in the newspaper within a few hours. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That sounds quite American, the way that command was barked, doesn't it?
But do you remember Ed Asner in an American TV series about a paper? I think Michael Douglas was in it, actually. But anyway, it didn't matter.
There was that one, Michael Keaton played the lead role.
Yeah.
And he was just like Martin Dunn.
Oh, was he?
He was a dead ringer for Martin.
He looks like Martin Dunn.
Yeah.
Yeah, an old colleague.
And Glenn Close was the managing editor or the owner or the proprietor. Glenn Close.
Glenn Close, right, okay, yeah. The one I remember, do you know the great Northern Irish actor, Jimmy James? You know the guy I'm talking about. He was in Cold Feet.
Nesbitt. Right. We were friends because his daughter was at my daughter's school.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. Okay. Well, I think Jimmy's a great guy because he's a big football fan. He's a United fan. Mm. And we once got on a train north together going to Old Trafford because Manchester United were playing Everton. So we met in the first class Virgin Lounge at Euston, you know. And he didn't know me, but I obviously knew him. And I introduced myself, and I said I was from Talk Sport. And he was captured immediately. He loves football, wanted to talk football. So we got into the first-class carriage and talked football all the way up to Manchester. You know, great guy. And I had a laugh with him about because he's made loads of TV programmes, most of which have been highly successful, but some have just quite not worked. There's one called Munro he did about a brain surgeon, and it just didn't work because, you know, sometimes you and I get involved in things that just don't work, you know. But this one I'm talking about, it was, and this is a great Fleet Street story, written about a notorious man in our business called Benji the Bin Man, okay? Now, Benji the Bin Man was notorious. He had a brilliant idea. He would go around the homes of famous people
stealing their
rubbish. He would go through their bins. This was in the days before people, you know, had worries about data and all that kind of stuff. Before they shredded anything, they would just throw their correspondence away. And Benji, in one bin at Elton John's home, he pulled out the fact that Elton John spent £256,000 a year on flowers for his house and all this kind of stuff. You know what I mean? And he was known as Benji the Bin Man.
There was a couple who were doing this. They were called the Vermeulens.
Right.
And they used to write books based on the rubbish that they stole from outside celebrities' homes.
Is that right?
And
yeah.
They had Madonna's hemorrhoid cream and used condoms and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they would piece together a picture of this, the secret life of the celebrity.
Yes.
Based on what they threw away.
Golly, that's amazing.
That is scraping the barrel, literally, isn't it?
Oh, I literally scraping the barrel. They're scraping, you know, papers out of bins and all that, take them. But the reason I laugh is Jimmy Nesbitt was Benji in Benji the Bin Man. And he asked me what I thought about it. You know, I said, well, it's ridiculous. Because in one scene, he meets a Fleet Street editor at 9 o'clock in a bar after having rung him up and said he'd been, you know, rooting through some, you know, star's bin, you know, some rock star's bin. And he had, you know, lots of fantastic information. And the editor said, I'll slip out, like it was Fleet Street or something, and meet you in, you know, the Popinjay or something, the bar downstairs. Slips out, goes in, buys a drink. Benji hands over a sheaf of papers, and the editor, without looking at them, sticks in his pocket and says, oh, brilliant, Benji, well done. That'll make the late splash. And walks out.
Which is far too late for the late 9 o'clock at night.
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
Exactly.
So, how hilarious.
You know, people thought you could change a newspaper in 5 minutes.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You
know, the truck is long gone. Oh, that's funny.
And it was, I say, well, but not only that, any self-respecting editor would spend 2 or 3 days checking the information in the paper that come out the bin anyway, you know,
or
what
having,
I mean?
Having some minion cross-check it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, he would get it checked, wouldn't he?
I had a funny story with Jimmy Nesbitt once.
Oh,
I was in the dry cleaners in Dulwich Village.
Okay.
Just after taking the kids to school. And, you know, we're all in. We used to gather in the dry cleaners.
Yes.
So there we are, all having a little chat with Mustafa, the guy behind the desk. And in comes Jo Brand.
Jo Brand?
And she just said not a word. She just walked in.
So, I've never warmed to Jo Brand.
No, she sort of marched in. Yeah. Flung open the door, marched in, said nothing, put a basket on the counter and pulled out the tiniest little pink neon skirt that you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah.
And just slapped it down on the counter and looked at Mustafa behind the counter as if to say, Yeah. And you're going to say what about this? Because quite obviously it would not have gone around one of her arms.
No.
Let alone around her waist.
Yeah.
And he said nothing either. He gave her a ticket.
Right.
She flounced out.
Yeah.
And then we all just collapsed in hysterics.
Right.
And that's the story.
Have you got a theory on where this skirt came from?
Probably one of her daughters, I would say.
But, yeah.
But it was a very funny moment because, you know, the look on Jimmy Nesbitt's face said the lot.
I should imagine. But anyway, there we go. Another tale from the annals of Fleet Street. Well, Leslie Ann, thank you very much indeed for joining me again for this podcast. Folks, we will be back with you soon. We'd love to hear from all of you out there. It's planetporkypod@gmail.com. Leslie Ann, your Twitter handle?
It's @LAJWriter.
It certainly is. And mine is @MikeParry8. Want to hear from you folks. We love doing these podcasts and we're delighted that the numbers are picking up so rapidly and the army of listeners to Planet Porky is expanding all the time. More to come very soon. Thank you, folks. Keep listening. But the problem was, I thought, because, one of them lived very close by and I thought, well, you know,
handy.
That's no good. Sorry?
Handy.
Well, not handy because, you know, the problem
she'll
is...
she'll stalk you after it's all over.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you get the bunny boilers around.
Well, that was my thought. I thought, if I only commit my... You know, if I just weaken once... I mean, I went out for one of these ladies, right? We went to a restaurant on Epsom Downs, okay? You know, Epsom Racecourse and beautiful part
of the
world.
Yeah, it's nice there.
And we had a long lunch and all that. And then I was very tempted, you know, because she'd finished work for the day and I thought, you know, shall I? And at the last moment, I decided not to because I thought this is going to cause me too much grief if she takes this as a sign of anything other than an afternoon's recreation. You see what I mean? When that started to wear thin, he started flushing them down the toilet.
So the drains were all bunged with human flesh.
The drains were all bunged up with human flesh. A guy from Dino Rod came along, opened a manhole, and then immediately called, called the police. But when the police got there, they found a head in his kitchen, in the fridge, because he couldn't get rid of the head.
He oversaw my column.
He oversaw your column. Yeah, I bet he was good at that. But he...
That's not a euphemism.
No, it's not. It's not a euphemism at all.